The stories behind the stories, what you may not know about the Founding Fathers and the beginning of our nation. As we prepare to celebrate Independence Day on the 4th of July, it is interesting to note that in the beginning, at least one of our Founding Fathers, John Adams, thought we'd be celebrating on July 2nd. That was the monumental day to him. So why do we celebrate on the 4th? That's a good question. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we have a guest who knows the answer. Kenneth C. Davis is the author of the wildly popular Don't Know Much About History series. Davis loves breaking down some of the myths of American history, discovering the unsung heroes of the past, and helping explain why many events and people are more complicated than we learn in school. What are your questions about American history? Maine Calling is next. But first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We learn some basics about American history in school, but most of us don't know much, and what little we know may not actually be that accurate. Our guest today is the author of a series of history books that fills in those gaps and corrects some misconceptions. He will share some of the real stories about our nation's founding fathers and other surprising insights into American history. Kenneth C. Davis joins us in the studio today. He is the best-selling author of the Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. Kenneth, it is always a pleasure to have you here in our studio.
It is honestly a great pleasure to be here. It's always fun to talk to you, and I always enjoy being here and talking to you, and then I get to talk to people around the state that I bump into, and they say, oh, I heard you the other day.
And oh, that's so terrific. And you've been exciting. Doing some public appearances this summer in Maine.
Yes, I was recently at the Blue Hill Library and the Belfast Public Library talking about actually, World War I, because we're in the midst of the 100th anniversary of America's involvement in World War I. And that's another story for next year, actually.
Well, we want to hear from you as well. Do you know why we celebrate Independence Day on July 4th? Do you know how many of the Founding Fathers were slaveholders? They weren't just Southern. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Let's start with the holiday. John Adams thought we would be celebrating July 2nd. Why did he think that, and why don't we?
Well, it would be a perfect idea, especially on this weird year when the 4th falls on Tuesday and some people have to go to work on Monday, but they had Sunday off. So here's the story. The Congress actually voted in favor of a resolution of independence on July 2nd. The resolution basically said that the United States was free and independent of Great Britain. John Adams went home and the next day wrote this lovely, flowery letter to Abigail back in Massachusetts, in which he talked about how this day, July 2nd, would go down in history. It would be a great celebration fest. There would be parades and bonfires and church bells ringing and illuminations, kind of like fireworks. So he was off by everything. He was right about everything except off by 2 days, because it was the Congress voting to approve Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, which explained why the Congress had voted 2 days before, the rationale behind independence that really became associated in the popular mind with the birthday of America. And I guess it would be nice if maybe we made it a regular 3-day event, you know, the 2nd through the 4th, but I'm not sure we're going to get that.
I think some people have that this year. but John Adams came in his lifetime to recognize the 4th, famously dying on the 4th.
This is one of the most extraordinary coincidences of history at all, and certainly in American history, that both John Adams and Thomas Jefferson die on July 4th, 1826, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. I mean, it would have been extraordinary enough if one of them had died, but these were the two men who were most closely associated with the creation of the Declaration. Adams had been named the head of a committee to draft a Declaration of Independence. He was joined by Benjamin Franklin, America's most famous man and certainly most famous writer at the time, and two other gentlemen, Sherman and Livingston from New York and Connecticut. And then they, at Adams's suggestion, added a fifth, Thomas Jefferson. Adams later said he added Jefferson and asked Jefferson to draft the Declaration because, first of all, he knew he needed a Virginian. Virginia was such a powerful presence in the colonies at the time, in the states to be at that time. He knew that he couldn't do it himself because people didn't like John Adams. They thought he was a little bit too far out
and
there, radical.
And he knew that people didn't like him.
And then the third reason that Adams gave was that Jefferson was 10 times a better writer than he was, which may be true. But at any rate, it's Jefferson then that drafts this document on his a little portable desk of his own design. You could actually call it the first laptop. He set this writing desk on his lap and wrote with a quill pen with it and drafted the Declaration, which then between July 2nd and July 4th, Congress then debated. And Thomas Jefferson was not happy about Congress picking over his words for 2 days.
Yeah, apparently he was in agony.
He was in agony, and he talked about it to Franklin afterwards, and Franklin basically told him a long story about the man who put on a hat sign, and he was a hat maker, and he described how beautiful his sign was, that it had said, beautifully designed hats made to order, and eventually it just gets down to hats, and Franklin says, well, they'll get the idea anyway, so... No, Jefferson didn't like the changes, and especially one, and we have to come back to this subject, and mm-hmm. I'm sure we will. The Congress deleted one major passage from Jefferson's draft of the Declaration of Independence, and in it, he complained about the slave trade, which is, of course, somewhat ironic.
Yes.
He was a slaveholder. He had enslaved approximately 100 people were enslaved at Monticello at the time of the writing of the Declaration of Independence. But he wrote this long denunciation of the King of England for keeping America from stopping the slave trade, which was really nonsense in a way and propaganda. Jefferson later wrote that this was taken out by the men who owned slaves as well as those Northerners making a great deal of money transporting them, which is a reminder that slavery existed in all 13 states and many fortunes were made through the slave trade,
including some of those by
signers.
You know, and that's what I wanted to talk about. You've had on your blog recently, you've been going about 10 or 11 at a time and looking at the lives of the signers of the Declaration of Independence and looking at how many of them owned slaves. I was surprised, Kenneth Davis, to learn how many of the New Hampshire delegation owned slaves.
Right. This is part of our kind of mythic or legendary or bedtime story version of history that, you know, slavery was something that was done by a few mean guys down in the South. And then it took Abraham Lincoln to solve the whole problem 150 years ago. Very simplistic notion. As I mentioned, slavery existed in all 13 colonies. By the turn of the end of the 18th and into the 19th century, it was really the biggest business in the world, the slave trade was. It was an enormous economic enterprise, and it made fortunes here in America. So when a man like William Whipple of Rhode Island is described, I'm sorry, of New Hampshire, is described as a merchant, one wonders, well, what is his merchandise? In fact, he shipped enslaved people aboard his ships and made money from it. Henry Lawrence, who is not a signer of the Declaration, but a very central figure in the Continental Congress later on, was a major slave trader. His son, John Lawrence, is now famous for those who have seen Hamilton as a close friend of Hamilton's, told his father that he was going to give up all of his enslaved people and really lobbied hard for Washington to include African Americans in the army. So this was a very complicated picture, but absolutely spread across every Benjamin Franklin himself enslaved at least two people as house servants. He took advertisements in his newspapers for runaways and for slave auctions, so he was profiting from it, even though he wasn't a massive plantation owner. He, by the way, also later becomes the founder of an abolitionist society because he sees the error of his ways, which not all of them did.
I want to get back to John Adams. Even though John Adams knew we would be celebrating Independence Day, he was also well aware of the fragility of what they were creating and wrote about that.
He did. They all fretted about it. Fretted about it in 1776, and they were fretting about it right through the war, of course, which ends in 1781 in terms of the fighting. The peace is settled in 1783, and it takes another 4 years after that, of course, for many of the same men to come back to Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 to craft a constitution, because the country as it was born and was being governed through the war years and the immediate aftermath of the war years was not a very successful enterprise. The separate states all sent delegations to Congress, but they voted as a single state. They didn't vote as single members. They had no power to tax. They had no power to raise an army. It was an ineffective form of government under what was called the Articles of Confederation. It was essentially a mutual defense pact, but not much more than that. And so that's why Franklin and Madison and Hamilton and some of the others who had been in Philadelphia in 1776 go back in 1787 to start it all over again by writing the Constitution.
You write that during the Constitutional Convention, there were delegates who were wary of an excess of democracy. And that brings one to think about today and what they might see or say about what's happening in the United States today.
Well, first of all, when we think about these men, we think about them as heroes, and we think about them very often as marble statues or paintings or the face on our coins. But they were men. They were human beings, first of all. They were also politicians, with all the baggage that that word implies. They had agendas. They had their regional interests. They had their personal self-interests that they were looking after. They had egos and ambitions, just as men do today, and women. Of course, in 1776, we're talking about men. And certainly, that's another issue we can come back to in terms of John Adams and his wife. The fact is that they saw this as a republic and looked sort of askance at democracy in a pure form. They believed that democracy was one step removed from mob rule. And that's one of the reasons that when they do write the Constitution in 1787, they leave the mechanics of voting up to the states for the most part, but they're going to essentially say the people are not capable of selecting the president, which is why we ended up with the so-called Electoral College. They feared regional interests. They feared religious interests overwhelming. These were men who worried about the power of parties. Washington warns about it when he leaves office, the what he called faction. Madison warns about it. Jefferson warns about it. Yet all three of them soon became involved in creating the first political parties. And we've had a divided political system since then.
What would they say if they were transported today? What would Adams think if he were in Maine, which formerly was part of Massachusetts, and he were emerged in this state budget shutdown, or looking at what's going on with Congress and health care? Is there any way to take that jump?
Well, I think it's again a little bit romanticized that we look back at these men and we see them as out of the figures in the movie 1776, for instance, that they're going to burst into song. But do remember that we're talking about, for instance, in the case of Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, peoples whose political infighting eventually led to a deadly duel in which the sitting vice president of the United States of America, Aaron Burr, kills the former Secretary of State, Alexander Hamilton, then goes back to Washington and presides over an impeachment hearing and does it to great acclaim, even while he's been indicted for murder, indicted but never tried and certainly never convicted. So, the notion that somehow politics and political men of the past were somehow above all the fray is a bit of romanticism and certainly an oversimplification and a sanitizing of our history. As I said, these are men with egos, ambitions, agendas. I mentioned John Adams recognizing that people didn't like him. He knew that he couldn't put forth a resolution of independence or write the Declaration of Independence, partly because people would object to him having written it. He knew, for instance, that George Washington was the only man to take the job of being made commander-in-chief in 1775, first of all because he was from Virginia, again, the importance of it. Washington had some military experience, famously wore his uniform to Congress as a not-so-subtle hint that he was a military man. But John Hancock, on the other hand, was furious that John Adams and then Samuel Adams, his two close colleagues from Massachusetts, nominate and then second George Washington as commander-in-chief rather than him, John Hancock, who had this rather inflated notion of himself as a military leader, and he wanted to be commander-in-chief of the army, which probably would have been disastrous.
Though you say George Washington wasn't quite the military genius that we have come to believe.
Well, he was first and foremost a tremendous leader, and he inspired tremendous admiration and loyalty from his men. He was clearly a disciplinarian. He was clearly a man who understood that an army had to be organized. When he comes to Boston, Cambridge exactly, in 1775, he's aghast at what he sees, that, again, democracy. People are electing their captains, and he sees men, a captain shaving somebody, and he's says no. Apart from the fact they don't know how to dig proper trenches, either for defense or for their sewage. So all of those things go into his certain ability as an experienced military man. But his experience as a military man had mostly come in the French and Indian War, part of what was called the Seven Years' War, the first global war in many respects. And Washington's experience there had been mostly disastrous. In 1755, he had surrendered his first command to the British at a place called Fort Necessity. And he was caught by the French after an attack on some French troops. The French easily could have strung him up right there or executed him right there, and history would have changed forever. He famously signs a confession for the French in which they use the word murder. He later says it was translated differently to him. So Washington essentially was accused later on of confessing to murdering a French diplomat. He was, though, present at the great disaster of the French and Indian War, the destruction of Braddock's troops, and performed heroically there. And that kind of made his mark and made his name both in America and in London. So that in 1775, there are very few Americans with any military experience. And when Washington comes into Philadelphia wearing a military uniform, it makes an impression. And John Adams even writes back to Abigail about how impressive Washington looks in his uniform. He did stand 6 feet tall.
Which was very tall for that
day. He was very
day.
Tall, especially among those men who were on the short side. 5'8" would have been typical, and men like Franklin and Adams were much shorter than that, and on the stout side. But Washington was tall, athletic, a tremendous horseman by all accounts. One little tidbit also. Washington's uniform was sewn by a man named Andrew Judge. He was an indentured servant from Scotland who had come to America to work for a period of years, and then he would be freed. Washington has Andrew Judge sew his uniform that he wears to Philadelphia. At about the same time, Andrew Judge has a child with an enslaved woman, and that child's name is Oney Judge. 20 years later, she escapes from Washington while he is president in Philadelphia, and comes all the way up to New England to escape him. He spends 3 years trying to track her down. So this is the daughter of the man who sewed Washington's uniform in 1775, later escapes slavery from Washington's household. This is how extraordinary these human stories and the interconnections between the system of slavery, the system servitude was to these people. It's a story I tell in my most recent book, In the Shadow of Liberty.
We do have to take a break. When we come back, your questions for Kenneth C. Davis. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Seniors Plus, Western Maine's agency on aging, Meals on Wheels, and more for older adults, disabled adults, and caregivers. SeniorsPlus.org. And Weiler's in Brunswick, committed to offering a colorfully curated mix of local goods, clothing, and gifts. On Main Street, next to Local Market and Cafe.
Hello, America. It's President Trump. And you know, the only thing that can get me off of social media is when I sit down and listen to the Capitol steps.
Every time the Donald goes,
tweet, tweet, tweet,
someone stop him.
Tweet, tweet, tweet,
can we block him?
Tweet.
So let's make America great again and listen to the Capitol Steps 4th of July radio special right here on this public radio station.
You can tune in for the Capitol Steps tomorrow at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or at 7 in the evening. Maine Public Television consists of four unique channels these days, our Maine HD channel, and Create, World, and PBS Kids. PBS Kids is a 24/7 commercial-free educational children's programming you can trust whenever you want. And that's not it, wherever you want as well. We also offer PBS Kids for online streaming on your mobile devices. To find out more, visit mainepublic.org and click on television or see your Experience member magazine. PBS Kids is a digital channel and, similar to World and Create, can be seen over the air and on most cable channels in our state. Enjoy.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the inside stories on the founding of our nation and other fascinating bits of American history. In the studio with me, Kenneth Davis. He's the author of the Don't Know Much About History series of best-selling books. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling. Or post to our Facebook page. Kenneth, I was reading or rereading America's Hidden History, one of your best-selling books, this morning, and I was so interested to think about Shay's Rebellion through the eyes of someone living in these tumultuous times. And I'd like you to just take us back, because I think we learn in school that after the revolution, there were factions of farmers who were still unhappy, and there was this rebellion. But it was easily suppressed. The people involved were kind of low lives. But you say that's just completely not true.
Well, it, like a lot of things that we learn in school, it's not. It ain't necessarily so, as Gershwin said in a different context. This is the story of a group of men who were living and working and mostly farming in western Massachusetts. Many of them were veterans of the American Revolution. And we're talking about 1784, 85, 86, in that realm. And what they were finding was, because the legislature was back in Boston, was making all these decisions, and they really had no say in matters, things weren't going the way they thought they were going to go when they took up arms in the American Revolution. Eventually, a group of these farmers and merchants and shopkeepers from the, or what is now around the Springfield, Massachusetts area, came together, and they decided they were going to take the federal arsenal in Springfield, which is where one of two arsenals at that time, take the cannon and rifle there and march on Boston and do what they had done in 1775, express their unhappiness with the government. But now, of course, there was an American government in charge. And so Samuel Adams, one of those men who had been in Philadelphia,
who had been a rabble-rouser,
a very chief rabble-rouser in 1776, was now saying, well, rebellion against the monarchy is fine, but rebellion against a republic is unacceptable. And he essentially helped create what was known as the Riot Act. So he was reading the riot. And they were going to send troops out to suppress this rebellion. Washington was watching this. Madison is watching this in 1786 and the early spring of early winter of 1787. And they're really afraid. It's what you were asking before about worrying about what was going to become of their child, this republic. That uprising, which is eventually suppressed, Americans killing Americans not in huge numbers, but certainly there were deaths among Shays's men, who were then became outlaws and chased off into Vermont, what became Vermont. These people were, as I said, Washington, Henry Knox, also famous here in Maine, Madison. They watched this and were really afraid for the future of America. And that was one of the true reasons that they came together and said, we need to come up with a better system of government, and of ultimately leading to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia in 1787.
Because the bottom line is, even though Shays Rebellion and other rebellions throughout the colonies were dangerous for
they
this
were
young republic, excuse me, states now, dangerous for the young Republican, those rebels or those people who were fighting actually had a point.
They absolutely had a point, because they basically felt that they had exchanged one tyrannical government for another. And they had been said, you know, they had read that Declaration of Independence when it becomes necessary to separate, that it was, you know, appropriate to redress the grievances. So this didn't just happen in Massachusetts. It was going on in New Hampshire. It was going on in many of the southern states in the Appalachian. And in many ways, it was a class war. And we don't think about America as being a class system, but certainly classes were already dividing up at this time. So the lawyers and the bankers and the politicians who tended to be in the cities like Boston were seen as not especially interested in the concerns of the farmers, the merchants, the men and women who were struggling to survive in a country that really had no monetary system, that was struggling with debt, that currency had been worthless, what they'd been paid in the so-called continentals was worthless money. So there were real reasons for a tremendous sense of this is not what we fought for when we went off to Bunker Hill and Lexington and Concord in 1775.
We're going to go to Penny, who's calling from Mount Desert Island. Hi, Penny. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, as you were talking, I had just been reading this article that I want to tell you about concerning the Roman Empire. It's in the American Conservative, the July-August issue. And it's written by Robert W. Mary. Anyway, she explores this whole subject of why we did not have a full-fledged democracy and why the founders did not allow that, because the history of the Roman Empire, when they ceased having kings and they went into the Roman Republic, came to a calamity. And Plato had actually predicted that this type of government leads to tyranny, and it's an extremely interesting expose of that. And so I just thought I'd let you know about it.
That is an interesting point. Thank you. Yes, the men who went from the founding fathers of the Revolution generation to the founding fathers, the framers who write the Constitution, James Madison chief among them, were painfully aware of the fact that most republics had not survived. Rome's Republic, of course, ends with Caesar taking dictatorial power and then becomes a dynastic empire. Benjamin Franklin worried about this, in fact, when they were writing the Constitution, because he said, what are we going to do if we elect a president and he's incompetent or corrupt? How are we going to get rid of him except by assassination? Perhaps thinking of Julius Caesar and the Senate. And that's why we came up with the idea of impeachment. So this has always been a kind of tension in American politics, American government, which is the idea of the fact that we are a republic, not a pure democracy at all. We have pure democracy, you know, in the town halls of New England, but not certainly not at the at a larger state, and certainly not at the national level. And it's always been that tension between individual rights and the government, between states' rights and the federal government, that have been at the source of so many of the controversies in our history.
Penny, thanks so much for calling in. If you'd like to call in, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. We have a tweet from L. Could Mr. Davis discuss a favorite female patriot that we may not have heard about in history class?
Female patriot. Well, I always start off with, and we've been dancing around this a little bit, Abigail Adams, because she was such an extraordinary personality and such an integral part of John Adams's life and career and politics. And of course, Abigail Adams, who writes this now famous letter, probably not in most school books 20 years ago, but certainly is in now, where she tells him as he's getting ready to write the Declaration of Independence that the new government that they create down here in down there in Philadelphia in 1776 must all include women. And she says, remember the ladies, very famously, because if you don't remember us, we will foment our own rebellion. Really throwing down the glove. And he kind of writes back a laughing letter and that says, oh, we will not give up our masculine rights so easily. And so she's an extraordinary character of that period. There were certainly women who fought in the Revolution. Most famously, perhaps coming to mind, is a woman named Deborah Sampson. Molly Pitcher was a real person. So there are quite a few rather extraordinary characters who, and we also have to remember the nameless ones, camp followers. This is something that gets a sort of, not a dirty name, but the notion that there were women who followed the soldiers and followed the army. Some of them would simply perform cooking and laundry. Sometimes wives followed their husbands into battle. Part of that human side of the story that history books often leave out that I find so fascinating. There are wonderful books written specifically about women in the Revolution that I could recommend a few titles. I'll post them on my website, perhaps.
Since we're talking about women, I want to ask you, did Betsy Ross really make the first flag?
Betsy Ross did not make the first flag the way we think of it. First of all, let's start with the fact that the flag in 1775, that would have been the flag in 1776, didn't look anything like the Stars and Stripes. It was called the Grand Flag of Union. And although it had the stripes, the red and white stripes, in the field where the stars would eventually be, there was the cross of St. Andrew and the cross of St. George. And when George Washington flew this flag over the troops in Cambridge, everyone looked at it and said, what is that? It created more confusion than anything. So later, in 1777, the flag design as we know it came into existence, and it's one of my favorite kind of anonymous signers who takes credit for it, a man named Francis Hopkinson. He was a poet, a philosopher, later a composer, actually wrote a song that gets the first copyright under American law. So an interesting character that most people have never heard of. He actually took credit for designing the flag as a member of Congress. He, in fact, submitted a bill to Congress for it in which he asked for a quarter cask of the public wine, which appealed to me greatly that's what he thought.
He was paid in wine.
Well, he asked for it. He didn't get it.
He didn't get it?
No, because the Congress determined that he was already on the payroll, so he wasn't going to get a quarter cask. I didn't even know there was the public wine. It's an area of research I haven't quite explored.
Yeah, I wonder if there still is the public wine, one of those deep secrets, right? We're going to go to Constantino calling from Westbrook. Hi, go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I was listening to your guest, and I was bemused by his statement that things ain't necessarily what they seem. And it reminded me of a great book I read when I was a kid. It was by the author. His name is Howard Zinn, and he's a political scientist. I believe it was written in 1980, and it's called A People's History of the United States, and that book is a real eye-opener. I'd like to hear your guest commentary about that.
I know Howard Zinn's work, of course, the late Howard Zinn. He used to teach in Boston, and his People's History is one of the fundamental texts of people, I guess, who would describe themselves and be described as revisionists. It's a book I've certainly am familiar with, and I would even say had some influence on my work, although our political views are not exactly in alignment. Howard Zinn was an avowed socialist and pretty adamant about it. So he always took the perspective that history had left out the stories of too many people. And I agree with him completely in that. The stories in particular of African Americans, women, Native Americans, and the working class to a large degree. And being a socialist, maybe even a Marxist, you would understand that he'd want to focus on the working class. But a profound influence on many, many teachers and writers in this field since his work came out. He tried to really look at history from the perspective of the people who had been left out of the books. And I think that's an important idea that I've tried to do as well.
Constantino, thanks for your call. If you'd like to call, 1-800-399-3566. We have to take a quick break. This is Maine Calling.
Later today on This American Life, I have no idea what gave me the confidence as a 12-year-old to take some books out of the Baltimore County Public Library about magic, put together a show, and then just start advertising to perform at kids' birthday parties. I did magic shows for years, and so did one of the producers on our radio program, David Kestenbaum. And this week, he and I dive back into that world to learn all kinds of things that we never knew about as kid magicians.
That's coming up this evening at 11 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio.
You can take my body, you can take my bones, you can take my blood, but not my soul.
On the next Fresh Air, Rhiannon Giddens. Her new album, Freedom Highway, includes her original songs based on slave narratives. It's been nominated for Album of the Year by the Americana Music Association. She'll perform in the studio. Join us.
You can take my body.
And you can hear Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock right here on Maine Public Radio. Coming up next in just a few minutes, ideas from the CBC. Today's topic is bringing up fur baby, the evolution from family pet to pet family. That's ideas from the CBC coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program American History, Inside Stories and Unknown Facts. My guest today, Kenneth C. Davis, who is a best-selling author about a series of books, What You Don't Know About History. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We were talking during the break, and I told Kenneth that I had taken my daughter to Valley Forge this past year. One, a beautiful, beautiful place. But we had this magical moment, Kenneth, where we were in the stone house where General Washington was stationed during that horrible winter with the guide by ourselves. It was right before closing time. And he was able to walk us through these very small rooms and tell us who would have been or who they think would have been bunking there. And and that Martha would have been there with George.
Martha was there with George, as well as quite a few of the enslaved people from Mount Vernon, including a fellow named William Lee, who I also write about in The Shadow of Liberty. But I wanted to discuss this because so many people have said to me, oh, how did you become a historian? How did you get interested in history? And I honestly say this, I was not a trained historian, but from a very early age, my parents took us to places. We'd throw army surplus sleeping bags and tents in the back of the car, and we would go to places like Gettysburg and Valley Forge or Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York on Lake Champlain. And from a very young age, I had the sense that history is not something that happens in books. It's something that happens to real people in real places. And when you see and smell and feel and touch those places, history comes to life. I have my souvenir from a trip to Gettysburg. By the way, today is day three of the Battle of Gettysburg in 1863, one of the most important days in American history. But I have my souvenir of going to Gettysburg in 1963 And standing in a field and knowing as a 9-year-old child that something extraordinary had happened in this place. And I always felt that that's what made me want to talk about history and write about it in the way that I felt I always loved it. And the beauty of this in Maine is that you don't have to go to Valley Forge. Yesterday, I went up to Castine. And there is the remnants of one of the most important battles that nobody ever heard of, especially people who might know one little thing about Paul Revere, because Paul Revere was there at a battle in 1779 that it did not go well for the American patriots. In fact, it was one of the great military naval disasters in American history, and Paul Revere was actually tried for cowardice and dereliction of duty after that. He was acquitted, but he lived in disgrace for a very, very long time after that judgment. And it's really only the poem much later that kind of revives his reputation.
And written by our own Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
Another connection. His grandfather, Peleg Wadsworth, was at the battle. And so it's interesting that Revere is featured in this poem by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow that kind of resurrects his career. And Revere's and Longfellow's own grandfather had been in that battle and performed much more heroically.
And while we're on the subject of Paul Revere, many of the bell in Bath's, is it City Hall, is a Paul Revere bell. But there's also a really interesting tidbit about him that I learned.
About setting teeth? Yes. Well, these are the human stories. One of the most fascinating characters when we talk about forgotten founders and people left out of history books. I've always been fascinated by a guy named Joseph Warren, and he's included in the book America's Hidden History because he was one of the real core believers in the Patriot group. And he was, interestingly, a connection between, we were talking about class before, the upper class people, the Adamses, the Hancocks, who were wealthy and well-to-do, and the merchants and artisans, the kind of mechanics, as they were called at that time. Warren played a role because he knew Revere and he knew these people as well. And it's Dr. Warren who actually gives Revere those orders that night to go out, take that message. They knew each other because Revere had given Dr. Warren a set of dentures. Apart from his silversmithing, he did dentures. And Dr. Warren dies at the Battle of Bunker Hill. He's one of the true martyrs of the early Revolution. Some months later, his body was thrown into a mass grave by the British. Some months later, Revere goes back to Bunker Hill, Breed's Hill, and identifies Dr. Warren's body because of the dentures. It was kind of the first CSI moment in American history, perhaps.
Amazing and macabre.
Yeah, but just that kind of human story that makes history so alive for me.
We'll go to Anna, who's calling from Pittsfield. Hi, Anna. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you very much for taking my call. I would love to hear what Kenneth has to say with regards to the Founding Fathers' church versus state, because in reading the Constitution, I find that it's really vague, and would love to have some clarity on that, if you would.
Oh, I don't think it's vague at all. If you read Article 6 of the Constitution, they use the words no religious test ever for any office. I think that one thing that is quite clear from my reading of history, Washington certainly would attest to this, and he wrote as much to the synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island. I would recommend anybody read that letter, a famous letter. Jefferson's view on separation of church and state were quite clear. Madison and Jefferson disagreed on, I should say, Adams and Jefferson disagreed on many matters of policy for a period in their life. At the end, Adams writes to Jefferson and says one of the great things they've accomplished is a republic in which there is no state church. And Madison himself, another of the most profound founding fathers on the question of separation of church and state, the author in some ways of the First Amendment, was very clear on this also. These were men who believed that, as another historian has put it, the business of government is to save men's rights, not their souls. And they believed that these matters of conscience, as they would have described it, were really left to the people. Did they believe that religion was important? Did they believe it was a fundamental idea in America? Yes, but they didn't want an official religion. They had gone to war against a country in which the head of state was also the head of church. They knew the long history of sectarian fighting in England and elsewhere, and they did not want to see that here. It's one of the reasons why these men were so adamant that this was a fundamental idea that they expressed in the Constitution, in the Article 6, and also obviously in the First Amendment.
Anna, thanks for your question. We're going to go to Bangor and Mike, who I believe has a similar question. Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. I believe you probably just answered it. I was going to ask, you know, weren't the founding fathers and mothers, I guess, weren't they more Unitarian than anything else? And what do you say to the people today who say that we were founded as a Christian nation? Thanks.
It's a great question, an important question. It's one I've written about a great deal in my career. If you go to my website, which is don'tknowmuch.com, I always have a list of articles there. I wrote for the Smithsonian, for instance, a few years ago, an article on the history of religious tolerance, which is actually the history of religious intolerance. This notion of a Christian nation, what it was in essence was not a Christian nation, but a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant nation. In most and many states, Catholicism was outright banned, including from the earliest days in Massachusetts. The deep divisions between Protestant and Catholic lasted a long time in this country. They were the source of tremendous discrimination, particularly against Irish Catholics, for more than a century in this country. And of course, John F. Kennedy was famously elected the first Roman Catholic president in the United States, and we think about that as a kind of small thing now, you know, an interesting little factoid. But it was an astonishing achievement and accomplishment at its time because of the deep hatred towards Irish Catholics in particular in this country. All the things that might be said about some form of immigrants today, they're dangerous, dirty, disease, they want to bring their own religion here, were said about Catholics in the early 19th century, well into the 20th century. And that's an important lesson for us to remember as well.
We'll go to Paula calling from Rockland. Hi, Paula, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I recently was able to visit Washington, D.C. for the first time and was quite impressed by a lot of sort of our intense history that just really, really hits you there. And one thing that I had no awareness of at all, and I'm jumping to the Civil War period now, is that the South officially surrendered on April 9th, 1865, and that Lincoln was shot on the 14th, 5 days later. I had no real awareness of just how close in time that happened. And at Ford's Theater, anyway, they were, you know, telling us that in part it was Lincoln's speech basically saying that he agreed with giving some sort of franchise to certain formerly enslaved men that really inflamed John Wilkes Booth.
John Wilkes, thank you for the call. And it's interesting that, you know, we're supposed to learn these dates, and sometimes we learn the dates and don't understand the close proximity or the connection to them. Obviously, of course, Lincoln had just returned essentially from going to Richmond, Virginia, which is not that far from Washington, D.C., the fallen capital of the Confederacy, and having sat in Jefferson Davis's chair. So this moment of extraordinary triumph. And he comes back, and of course, just a few days later, is assassinated by a group that were true hardcore Confederate secessionists, true believers. And it may not have been simply as a matter of their believing that Lincoln was going to give the emancipated African Americans the vote, as it was their hope that by removing him, that they could open up the whole thing all over again. And it was a last desperate act by men who had been involved with in other conspiracies. And it was a fairly large conspiracy to take out not just Lincoln, but the head of the War Department, the vice president, and the Secretary of State. Those attacks, of course, all failed. But this was we talk about today. It's interesting, I think, that people talk about how divided the country is. And I say, if you want to see the divided country, look at 1861 and then in 1865, because it took so, so long for the country to be knit back together. And in many ways, we've never been truly knit back together.
Paula, thank you for your call. We have a email here from Kevin. As a proud Acadian from northern Maine, I've always been curious if the persecution of the Acadians by the British played a role in drafting the Bill of Rights. For example, did the disarmament of Acadians in 1755 lead to the Second Amendment?
I don't think that there's any connection that I am aware of between the Acadians and the Second Amendment in particular, or any particular aspect of the framing of the Constitution. The Second Amendment, obviously, we have a few minutes left, would be a few hours show. The contention has always been that this Second Amendment was created, if you read the literal words are for the defense of the state, a well-trained militia. The argument has been on one side that this was designed at a time when the United States had no standing army, largely because the founding fathers were really suspicious of of standing armies, and also were really cheap. They didn't want to pay for one. They were afraid of they thought soldiers were one step removed from scoundrels. They called them men of the sword. They didn't want professional armies. They thought we should rely on militias, and hence the Second Amendment in the view of many. Others believe, as the late Justice Scalia did, that this was an individual right to somehow defend and protect ourselves from an oppressive government. That is a controversy that will probably persist for many long years.
As you mentioned, Kenneth C. Davis, we're low on time, but I want to ask you as a final question, what are you going to be thinking about tomorrow on the 4th of July? What does this holiday mean to you?
For 30 years, I've been struggling with this question. How do these men who write these words, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and pledge their lives and their fortunes and their sacred honor to these ideals, and take enormous risks doing it, how do they then go home to plantations utterly dependent upon enslaved labor? Washington, Jefferson, Madison, almost all of them. 40 or 41 of the 56 signers are slaveholders. Washington was not a signer, but obviously a major slaveholder of the time. This is the great contradiction in our past, that a nation conceived in liberty was also born in shackles. And I can't escape that idea. And I've spent my life trying to figure out how to balance those things off. These men as heroes who were also protected and preserved a crime against humanity.
Well, thank you so much. Always a treat to have you here. Kenneth C. Davis, the author of the Don't Know Much About History books and a series of other books about the lesser known aspects of U.S. history. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn produced the program. This program will be rebroadcast at 8. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.